Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Matthew Ho, Associate Director of the Eisenhower Media Network, who assesses the legality of Donald Trump's attack on alleged drug boats and threats of U.S. military action targeting Venezuela. Bruce Ackerman, Professor of Law at Yale Law School, who discusses the critical issues being decided in a Supreme Court case that could further increase President Trump's unchecked executive power. And journalist and author Nell Bernstein, who talks about her new book titled In Our Future We Are Free, which documents the successful movement that over 25 years dramatically reduced youth incarceration across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As President Donald Trump canceled all federal commemorations of World AIDS Day in December, major cuts in U.S. and other nations' funding for AIDS treatment and prevention is predicted to increase HIV infections by 3.3 million over the next 5 years. Nations across Africa, the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic, are expected to be hardest hit. The Guardian reports that AIDS-related deaths in Zimbabwe rose for the first time in 5 years. In poor nations like Ethiopia and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, patients with suspected HIV infections remain undiagnosed as test kit supplies have run out. Over the last 2 years, the U.S., United Kingdom, and the European Union have slashed their funding for foreign assistance programs battling HIV/AIDS by 40%. New reports from UNAIDS and various AIDS charities have related devastating stories of suffering as World AIDS Day was observed on December 1st. Several African nations have initiated new AIDS treatment programs, but are unable to make up the huge gap left by the withdrawal of Western donor nations. South Asia is one of the most water-stressed regions in the world and is now facing escalating water wars driven by climate change, water scarcity, energy security, and geopolitical rivalries. The U.S.-based Pacific Institute reports 191 water-related disputes in South Asia between 2019 and 2023. India, Pakistan, and China are now vying for control over shared rivers like the Indus and Brahmaputra. China's proposed a $167 billion dam on the Yarlung Tsapo River in western China and Tibet, which would be the world's largest dam if completed, but it threatens India and Bangladesh's access to water downstream. In October, Afghanistan unveiled plans to build their own dam on the Kabul River, raising tensions with Pakistan, which resulted in border skirmishes with the Taliban government. Without greater cooperation, the impact of climate change and aggressive nationalist water policies risks escalating regional disputes, potentially leading to broader conflicts across South Asia. The day after the Thanksgiving holiday, an 11-hour blackout of a key Chicago Mercantile Exchange data center due to a computer system cooling failure disrupted global futures trading from Tokyo to London. The blackout illustrated the vulnerability of the global economy to data centers that are now driving the explosion in artificial intelligence. Data center companies receive massive state tax subsidies, which benefit big tech giants like Google. Meta and Microsoft rely on data centers to drive the AI economy. A recent study reveals only 11 states disclose the names of companies getting huge tax write-offs for their data centers, and even fewer disclose the value of those tax breaks or jobs created. Further, no states report on the corporate owners of data centers. In fact, state governments calculate losses between 52 and 70 cents for each dollar spent on data center tax breaks. The study recommends that states sharply reduce public money spent on data centers by ending or reforming taxpayer-funded corporate tax exemptions. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Since September, President Trump has ordered the U.S. military to wage a campaign to destroy small boats in the Caribbean and Pacific Oceans that the administration claims are carrying illegal drugs to the U.S., linked with Venezuela's government. As of December 10th, the Pentagon reports that it has attacked 23 boats, killing 87 people. The administration argues that their attacks on these boats and the resulting deaths of those on board that they label as narco-terrorists are legal under the rules of war. But legal experts say under U.S. and international law, there is no current armed conflict with alleged drug cartels that could justify these lethal attacks and may constitute war crimes. Controversy further erupted after a Washington Post report that Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth had given a verbal order to kill two survivors of a September 2nd U.S. boat strike. Hegseth later shifted responsibility for the order to Admiral Frank Bradley, while supporting the decision to kill all survivors aboard that boat. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Ho, associate director of the Eisenhower Media Network, a former Marine captain, Iraq War combat veteran, and Afghanistan State Department officer, who resigned in protest over U.S. war policy in 2009. Here he takes a critical look at the U.S. boat attacks and the Trump regime's announced intention to launch airstrikes against Venezuela, as well as covert CIA operations against the oil-rich country.
What we have with this concentration or this focus on these strikes that I believe occurred on September 2nd, where two survivors of an initial strike were then killed 45 minutes later by a second strike. The focus on that, first of all, misnaming it, referring to it as a war crime when it wasn't a war crime. We're not at war. These are not belligerents. These are not enemy combatants. This is murder. This was just the second set of murders that occurred after the first set of murders. And that's the way it should be viewed as. And the problem you have is by this emphasis on the second strike, the double tap strike, as it's called, and whether this is a war crime or not, that takes away the discussion about the larger reality that these are all just 23 experiences of organized murder. It doesn't get into the precedent that allowed it. And I think that's a major issue for us that we should be discussing in this country is how did we arrive at this point? You know, and so if you don't have the precedent established by the gross violations of civil liberties by the George W. Bush administration, if you don't have the expansion of the drone program by Barack Obama, including the use of double tap strikes to kill first responders, the Obama administration's killing of American citizens by drones, right? If you don't have, say, the holding to account for war crimes and the aiding of the United States, of Israel in the last 2 years in Israel's genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza, if you allow all these various illegalities, all these federal crimes to occur without anyone being held to account, well, that sets a precedent where here we are now, where, of course, the Trump administration is acting with impunity because they believe the precedent has established that they have no reason to be held accountable for anything, that what they're doing is legal. And that's the real danger. And by having this conversation only being about those two men who were murdered after the other nine men or so were murdered, erasing this whole larger conversation of the legality of the whole action, you're establishing precedent for this to occur again in the future.
Matthew, the White House announced last week that they were declaring a no-fly zone over Venezuela. Obviously,
The whole attempt at regime change in Venezuela to overthrow the government of Nicolas Maduro is tied in, importantly, with oil. Venezuela has the largest known oil reserves in the world. I wonder if you'd talk about what you believe would be the consequences of the U.S. either delivering airstrikes in support of a ground force, maybe made up of opposition politicians and militias that they might control. What kind of chaos and destruction do you think would be unleashed if the U.S. were to proceed with this plan to overthrow the government of Venezuela?
I think Libya in 2011 is a fair model to look at. I think certainly there are differences. The United States would not invade Venezuela in the manner in which it invaded Afghanistan or Iraq. So I think the Libya model is a fair model, as you described, Scott. Airstrikes, drone strikes, cyber attacks, special operations forces, the use of mercenaries, anything to keep the cost down in terms of American casualties. And then utilizing opposition forces on the ground to remove Maduro from power. And we can imagine how messy that would be, how the strength of the Maduro government is well established in terms of, you know, whether or not getting people to turn out in the streets, whether or not getting people to show up for elections. Certainly the opposition has strength, too. So you can see that neither side is weak. And so you can imagine whether it's a clean ousting of Maduro, and then the opposition takes power, and then the resistance that would come from those who are usurped, right? Or the fact that Maduro comes out of power, there's a vacuum, and then you can imagine the fighting that goes on to fill that vacuum of power. Or you can see where Maduro's not removed from power, right? And these airstrikes continue for however long, and he suppresses the opposition, and it's bloody, and it's horrible, right? I mean, so you can imagine all these different scenarios. The thing I think that's most important is that all of these scenarios bring about instability and suffering, and not just for the 30 million people in Venezuela, but for the entire region.
That was Matthew Ho, associate director of the Eisenhower Media Network, a former Marine captain, an Iraq War combat veteran. Find links to analysis and commentary on Trump's attack on alleged drug boats and threats against Venezuela by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The issue of whether a U.S. president has the power to fire members of independent federal agencies is now being considered by the U.S. Supreme Court. In August, President Trump attempted to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook from the Federal Reserve, but the Supreme Court ruled she could keep her seat until the justices take up that case in early 2026. Trump also fired Rebecca Kelly Slaughter from the Federal Trade Commission in March. It's that case, Trump versus Slaughter, that the justices heard arguments on from lawyers representing both sides on December 8th. A 90-year-old Supreme Court decision in the case called Humphrey's Executor versus United States upheld the independence of these executive branch agencies. President Trump argues that since they are part of the executive branch, the president should have complete control over them. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bruce Ackerman, Sterling Professor of Law at Yale Law School, a constitutional scholar, and author of 19 books, including his three-volume series on American constitutional history titled We the People. In a recent paper, he opined that if the six conservatives on the court overturn Humphrey, they will not only be enabling Trump and his successors to transform a host of independent agencies into mere playthings of partisan loyalists dispatched by the White House, but they'll be shattering the entire American tradition. Professor Ackerman believes there are differences of opinion on this case between one of the Trump-appointed justices and the president's other appointees, and he holds out hope that the Supreme Court may come down on the side of protecting the independence of these federal agencies.
Let's start with this remarkable argument. The person who was really brilliant is Amy Coney Barrett, who I should emphasize is a Trump appointee. And it was she, however, who kept on pressing and emphasizing the fundamental mistakes made by her fellow justices who are Trump appointees, and indeed supported in brilliant ways the arguments of the three Democrats. This case has rocketed up to the Supreme Court in incredibly rapid time. They're going to have to think a lot about what Coney Barrett has said. Now, what does she say? First, and this is a big mistake that lots of the justices made, the independent agencies do not involve Congress stealing the power of the president. First, and most obviously, if Congress wants an independent agency, the president can veto it if he doesn't want it. The fact of the matter, and this is what she emphasized, is that the beginning of independent agencies occurs in 1887 under Grover Cleveland. And why does Grover Cleveland, who is president and could create an agency and that he could dominate, why does he insist that the agency be independent? The answer is the robber barons. The robber barons are owning the three railroads that take all the agricultural products from the West and ship them to the East, as well as lots of manufacturing things in places like Chicago. And what the robber baron monopolists do is figure out how to charge shipping fees, which exploit their monopoly profits and strip all the workers and the businessmen of the competitive returns that they should be getting. And the problem, though, is that neither the Congress nor the courts, if Congress just passes a law which says that the railroad shall charge a fair and equitable rates, how are they going to figure them out? Judges are not number crunchers, nor is a political appointees. What we need is people who are number crunchers, who are selected and have a special staff. That precedent is then taken up by every president of the early 20th century. So it is of fundamental importance for both ordinary thoughtful Americans to recognize the disaster that if we don't be true to this history.
The sentence that grabbed my attention when you talked about the Roberts Court being one that is overturning precedents. The first one I think of is Roe v. Wade. It got overturned. Can you just summarize any other ones that have occurred under the Roberts Court? And this one could possibly be another if conservatives vote to overturn it.
What's happened in the first 8 months of the Trump second administration is that the Supreme Court has operated on something called the emergency docket.
Right.
And what it has done so far is very threatening, because here we've had 20 or more serious judges or panels of three throughout the country finding that in one way or another, President Trump is violating statutes of a fundamental kind, but they're different statutes in different contexts. Generally speaking, what the Supreme Court has traditionally done is let these injunctions issued by the lower courts stand until for the another year or 18 months while the cases come up to the Supreme Court. The court can hear arguments and then think and deliberate before they come to a final decision. So during this provisional period, the president has to wait. Then and only then, if the Supreme Court says the president is right and the lower courts are wrong, then the president wins. But today, what we've had is the Roberts Court on this so-called emergency docket has removed almost all of the injunctions, so that the president, within the first 4 months, issued hundreds and hundreds of orders that many judges have found illegal, and he's gotten away with it. He's actually putting them into practice right now.
That was Bruce Ackerman, Sterling Professor of Law at Yale Law School. Learn more about the core issues in the Trump versus Slaughter case and find links to Professor Ackerman's related essay by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The United States, with nearly 2 million people behind bars at any given time, has the highest incarceration rate of any country in the world. The nation spends about $182 billion annually on prisons, with little progress to show on rehabilitation or crime prevention. America's outsized prison population can be traced to decades of tough-on-crime policies, including the war on drugs, leading to longer mandatory minimum sentences and three strikes laws. The racial disparities in the U.S. prison system are stark, owing to endemic bias in the criminal justice system and growing economic inequality. While the U.S. today incarcerates more young people than any other country in the world, the total number of children serving time in America's prisons has dramatically declined over the past 25 years. Award-winning journalist Nell Bernstein, who spent years writing about the juvenile justice system and the impact of prison on young lives, is the author of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison, and All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. Your reporter spoke with Bernstein about her newest book, titled In Our Future We Are Free, The Dismantling of the Youth Prison, which recounts how over the last two decades, a coalition of parents, activists, and prison officials launched a successful campaign in states across the U.S. to end the prosecution of young people as adults, slashing the number of children behind bars by a stunning 75%.
I'm as surprised as anyone to be bearing good news at this moment, but I've been reporting on youth incarceration for 20-odd years, and remarkably, what's happened in the last 25 years or so is that the number of kids incarcerated in this country has actually dropped by 75%. And over that same time period, we've closed at least two-thirds of the youth prisons in this nation. That said, we were in the 90s and remain today the world's leading incarcerator of children. So it's good news in a very bad scenario.
You report on the campaigns that was led by mothers, activists, attorneys, abolitionists who confronted the juvenile prison system. And after years of struggle, they've won many victories across many states at reducing the number of incarcerated youth in the U.S., as you just said, by 75%. Please tell our listeners about the conditions of these juvenile prisons. And I know it varies from one state to the other, but maybe we could start with the conditions that you examined in Tallulah, the Tallulah Correctional Center for Youth in Louisiana. That seemed like an extreme example of some of the worst conditions across the country.
Tallulah was a horrific institution. Kids there were routinely brutalized. One of the more shocking details I uncovered was that at one point they brought in a warden from the Angola State Penitentiary to kind of try to restore order. And even he was shocked to find that, as he put it, nearly every kid had a broken nose or a perforated eardrum. That said, you could find these kinds of abuses and practices like putting children in solitary confinement, underfeeding them, just every kind of neglect and abuse in every state in the country. And that was true in the 90s, and it is true today. Even though there's been a lot of progress on reducing the number of kids who are incarcerated, I keep track of this stuff, and every day I wake up to horror stories in my inbox. So Tallulah was particularly bad, but this is happening in every state in the country.
You talk about the campaign that was organized, I think kicked off by mothers of incarcerated young people. They eventually triumphed, as you talk about in the book. I wonder if you talk about the strategies and tactics that this group of political neophytes successfully employed to eventually, years later, shut down that notorious correction center for youth.
Yeah, what the mothers did in Louisiana was just one piece of a larger puzzle involving young people themselves, movement lawyers, advocates, politicians, even some system leaders. But they did two things that I think are central to any effort to close a prison. Prisons depend on invisibility to function. There's a reason that we put them in the middle of nowhere. The gates and bars and razor wire that keep kids inside them also function to keep the rest of us out. And the other thing that I think these youth prisons depend on is dehumanization. The abuses that children experience are so extreme that in order to justify them, we have to call the kids super predators and just not look at them in their full humanity. So what the mothers did was they pierced this veil of invisibility, and they essentially demanded that their children be seen as human. You know, in California, mothers stood outside the gates with signs, with pictures of their children as beaming toddlers, just to say, this is a child like any other child. In Louisiana, the parents conducted a series of sort of dramatic street theater actions. At one point, they held a jazz funeral in New Orleans to symbolize the mourning of their children's youth and their children's dreams. And they pulled a casket down the street. There were jazz bands. So yeah, they were neophytes to start, but they were also, out of desperation, very quick studies. And in Louisiana, they had a strong partnership with civil rights attorneys. They triumphed in the sense that they closed Tallulah, but 25 years later, a new generation of parents is fighting, for example, to protect kids who were sent to the old death row at Angola a couple of years ago. Angola is a notorious prison. It's a former slave plantation where men still work the fields under the watch of armed guards. So fewer kids, but the horrors to which we're willing to subject them remain almost unbelievable. And these parents are still fighting 25 years later.
That was journalist and author Nell Bernstein talking about her new book titled In Our Future We Are Free, The Dismantling of the Youth Prison. Learn more about the ongoing campaign for reform of America's juvenile justice system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, WFMP in Louisville, Kentucky, KODX in Seattle, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.